So Nurse Chapel comes back, but she's not Nurse Chapel. She's a much more annoying character. Isn't that exciting?
Wait, that was...
Yes. You are really bad at this.
Oh my God. Wow.
That is Majel Barrett Roddenberry playing the role of Lo'Oxana Troi.
Probably the worst character. Oh my God. I did not pick up on that.
Single-handedly, I believe, the worst character.
Yeah.
In the entire Star Trek franchise. Worse than Wesley. Worse than Chekhov. Worse than all of the people in Star Trek Voyager who I can't even name because that's not a real show. Tuvok. And yeah, Haven is, it's just awful. Like, there's no way around it. It's just bad.
You want to have Counselor, you know, Counselor Troi's mother is a very big contrast. I get how they wanted to make her a very, you know, annoying, you know, loud and very.
Why?
That's one thing.
But no, I don't agree with you because that is the obvious place to take someone's mother. Like, oh, her mother is annoying and loud and meddling. Well, that's not like every single mother character in fiction ever. Make it something else.
Well, here's the I mean,
and then they get locked into this. You don't understand. You don't have history with her. She's in fucking everything for like ever. She appears in like, I don't know, 102 episodes of The Next Generation. She's in like 45 episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Oh God, really?
I don't understand. Like, obviously she was played by Majel Barrett Roddenberry. So she had a lot of like traction with the creative team that was behind the Star Trek franchise. She did the computer voice. So she was around the set anyway. So I guess they figured every once in a while they'd throw her a bone and write a Lo'Oxana Troi episode. But they're never good.
Well, because it's not even like she's a funny, annoying mother character. Like, I think it's really interesting. I think the concept of having Troi out of her element or having her where she is, and let's go with what the show tells us, you know, where she is very good at her job and she is very, you know, usually very strained, very diplomatic, very politic. And then her mother is, again, the complete opposite. She's annoying, but I don't think the show realizes she's quite as horrible as she is.
Well,
I think the show thinks that we're going to be amused by Lo'Oxana Troi's antics because she is this... Like, if they wanted to make her an anti-MAME kind of character who's just very vibrant and very blunt and very, you know, not afraid to say how she feels and, you know, very surface emotions, like, that could be interesting. But they just make her... She's really boorish, frankly. She's just obnoxious, and she has very few redeeming qualities to the degree that I think she makes me hate the entire Betazoid race.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah. I think, this is... Okay, so I think there's something interesting there. Number one, I do have to say, I was not aware of how much vitriol I had for Lo'Oxana Troi.
I can see why.
But it's very annoying. There's a couple things there. Number one, what you're saying is very prescient for a reason, because they do use her, I guess I'll say, better in later episodes.
Okay.
And I'm trying not to color your expectations too much, but, you know, you've seen a couple seasons of the show, so you kind of know at least a little bit about where it goes and where these characters eventually end up.
And I can see putting her in the hands of a competent writer, you know.
And so what actually happens is that Lo'Oxana Troi does become... I never find her funny. I mean, yeah. I just hate the character and I hate everything she's in. But they do at least soften her a bit and they make her more of a comic relief character. Yeah. So that is, you know, that bang on for you for pointing that out. But the interesting thing is here, and I think where we can go with this is, again, this is a show made by people who don't really understand, like, the strengths of the cast, don't really get what they're doing yet. They don't have a well-formed idea of what the show is going to be. And, you know, this, interestingly enough, this episode was filmed much earlier than it was aired. Okay. So I believe this was like the fifth episode filmed or something like that. And I think you can see that, you know, because as the show's been going on in the season and now we're about halfway through, it's getting a little better.
It's starting slowly to find its voice.
A little bit. And the show will not find, as I've said, the show will not completely find its voice until season three. So I think a lot of the problems with this episode is just that it was made earlier as well. I don't know. It's Lawaksana Troy is just an extremely problematic.
Obnoxious, odious. She's boorish. She's just. And the thing is, see, there's a couple of interesting half episodes that start to appear, but then Lawaksana comes into the scene and just starts anticing around and just takes. She sucks all of you. So the main plot of this episode, I guess, as far as. As an external threat goes, is these Talarians. And they have a very interesting story, at least. It's that, you know, they are irrevocably infected by a biological weapon. They destroyed their own planet. It's these last few refugees. They're sick. They're dying. So you do have an amount of compassion for them because they are without a planet. They are dealing with.
Do you?
They're dealing with the consequences of having making a really horrible war decision, and you can't. You know,
really.
What do you mean?
I find them non-entities in this episode. Well, they're,
and that's what I'm saying. Like, they have an interesting concept that they do nothing with. They could have made a lot of really. They could have used that to be a very interesting. You have this concept of you have the people who. It is our mission to provide humanitarian aid for the sick and the dying. At the same time, by opening up that ship, they are exposing everybody to this biological agent. I mean, it's very clearly said, if anybody from Haven catches this, they have to be quarantined forever or else it's going to outbreak and cause the same exact problem. That's an interesting situation. And yet, they're this weird, creepy sex cult at the end that just does nothing.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the whatever the fuck they're called, you know, I think our roles are reversed for whatever reason with the Next Generation, because I used to care a lot about, like, getting the names right, and now I'm just like, what the fuck ever, who cares? I just think the Next Generation is making me angry, frankly.
I could see why.
That, like, you know, they're definitely, they have some sort of seeds of something, right? And I think, you know, if you saw a better episode in here, and I don't want to get into, like, sort of abstract script doctoring or, what the episode could have been or what would have made it better. But I think, like, you know, if you had made the episode about them instead, and the sort of, you know, Haven subplot, whatever, with the arranged marriage and stuff, that should have been the B plot.
And they made the most interesting thread of a story here is maybe even a C plot, I'd say, at best.
Because the thing is about the early season of that we've seen so far of the show is that, like, they've had what, like, three episodes about main cast members leaving, possibly. And it's just, there's no dramatic tension there whatsoever, because we had, you know, Picard possibly getting into some deep trouble in the battle. We had Riker possibly leaving with his Q powers and hiding Q last week. And now we have an episode where it's explicitly stated that if Troy gets married, she's going to have to leave Starfleet because I guess it's the 17th century.
Yeah.
And like, and so, but the thing is, like, there's no dramatic tension there. And it's this overused plot device in the first season, I'm finding, because these characters are not going to go anywhere. They're not going to leave.
Even coming from a first season, I mean, we know this knowing that, you know, and Troy stays with the entire show, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, we know seeing that, you know, she is never going to, but even if you are watching, if this is it's 1987, the episodes aired for the first time, she is a main cast member, and it's 1987, shows don't do that. They're not going to actually, you know, remove a character in the first season. So, that tension is diffused. I think part of the problem for me is that this is reminding me of two very specific Star Trek episodes, and I know I've, you know, keep going on to this, but this is partially Journey to Babel, and this is partially a Muck Time, in that the plot of one is a cast member, you know, one of the characters is getting married, and the other in that we are meeting their family and learning about their culture. Now, and also, you know, I'd said earlier, you know, she's kind of an emotional Vulcan in a lot of ways. She is kind of the Spock role in this, in a very different, as far as being half alien, having half alien powers and all of that. And yet, you know, again, Amok Time and Journey to Babel were wonderful episodes. You learn a lot about Vulcan. You learn, you know, in this, the Betazoids are seen as obnoxious, and Troi doesn't even do anything in her own episode. She reacts to a couple things. She yells at people at dinner. And otherwise, she just kind of walks around angsting about what's going on. Well, she you know, all of the decisions that anybody else on the show makes are by other characters, mostly by her husband-to-be.
Yeah, and I think that's especially problematic because there would have been a way to get into, like, I don't know that I necessarily care a lot about finding out about the Betazoid culture. I mean, part of the problem with this episode, I mean, you mentioned Amok Time, but Amok Time worked, you know, primarily because it came in the second season. We had an entire season of episodes that we got to know the character of Spock. We got to learn about Vulcan a little bit. We got to learn about sort of the relationship that they had with humans and Earth. And so Amok Time is a great episode to sort of go, okay, you know as much as we've told you about Spock so far, you know as much as we've told you about Vulcan so far, you want to see this. We know you want to see this. So here's more about Vulcan. Here's more about their society. Here's more about what their planet is like, what their culture is like. The problem with this episode is that we don't know who Troi is, really. You know, even putting aside the fact that this was like the fifth episode film, but like the 12th episode aired, it's not a huge difference. You know, so we don't have a good sense of Troi as a character. We don't have a good sense of Troi as sort of like a representation of her race. She never seems to have any sort of like conflicted feelings about being half human, half Betazoid. And really, you know, Betazoids seem to be humans, except they can read minds and they get married naked. And it's not a super interesting species or a super interesting culture.
Well, see, for a while prior to this episode, it kind of was to me, because I do wonder, what do you have when you have a society which is very based on emotions and which can read each other's? I mean,
and that would be interesting.
I could almost see Betazoid society as being a very restrained society, just because, frankly, everybody's worried about offending each other or
being
about hurting each other. And
being sort of the analog, you know, sort of being the reverse of Vulcans in a way.
Yeah.
And I think if you had been on the writing staff of The Next Generation in 1987, that's probably what you would have written, and Haven would have been an awesome episode.
And then you see this, and
good job for you, Richard.
Yeah. But then you see what Lwaxana Troi is, and she is the only full-blooded Betazoid we have seen on the show, correct?
I believe it, so,
because
yeah.
Because her servant is another type of alien.
Yeah, I don't know what he is, but yeah.
She is the first full-blown Betazoid, and she is embarrassing. She's horrible. And so I am picturing a Betazoid dinner where everybody's ringing gongs left and right and screaming at each other. And I mean, maybe it's like an Italian dinner, but like, it just sounds very exhausting.
Right.
And now I don't want to go to Betazoia.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's interesting because, you know, there are a couple of areas where the show, this episode could have gone right. Like, either make, you know, it seems incidental to me, number one, that Troi's half human. She doesn't ever, it doesn't seem to be important. Like, her father's not even there. I guess they got divorced or something, because my God, how could you stay married to Lwaxana Troi for more than an hour?
Again, Major Baird in her prime was pretty, you know? She's not bad looking.
No, she's still not bad looking in this episode.
So, I mean, like, her, you know, after, you know, he was just blinded by her beauty for a few weeks, and then,
and
you
I
know,
don't,
Detroit
and, you know,
happened.
I do have to say, like, I mean, this is, I don't believe that this is the fault of Major Baird Roddenberry. No. Like, she did the best she could with this material. She's a competent actress. She's fine, you know, but the material she's given is just not very good, and I don't think that she's not a superior actor to sort of like make more with the material than she's given. I think if she has good material to work with, she makes it work. If she has bad material to work with, she's not able to rise above it.
I think she's more interesting like when she's, I don't know. I found her the most interesting as number one, frankly, back in the pilot, when she was doing this very restrained and very, I'm not sure what the term to describe her is, but she's a very stoic role, I guess.
Controlled, very closed off. Yeah. But I think the interesting thing here is, you know, either do something with the fact that Troi is half human, which they never really do in this episode, or do something with the fact that her her husband to be, and his parents are human. See, and so my issue with the episode is, like, they never went into like, it was sort of intimated that this human family lived on Beta Zed, and they never really came out and said that, I think, but that's kind of the implication I got. Go into that. Like, why would a human family living on a foreign planet, like, agree to an arranged marriage? Because that's not something that, you know, and if we use the Federation, and if we, you know, use Starfleet as sort of like analogs of, you know, Western 20th century democracy, which I think is a fair thing to do, Western 20th century citizens of democracies don't enter into arranged marriages. So why would would they have been so ready to do that? That's interesting to me, but they don't go into that at all.
There's a story between Loxana and the other, what is their last name?
I don't know.
The white people that are marrying their, you know, her daughter.
They're like Lutherans, basically. Yeah. They're from Minnesota or something.
I don't know. I assumed that Troy's backstory is similar enough to Spock's. You know, maybe it's complete opposite, where, you know, the mother is a full-blown alien and the father is, you know, maybe he's an Earth representative on the planet, you know, for an ambassadorship or something like that. He marries, you know, a local. You know, I figured it was something along those lines. You get the sense that this other couple is an Earth couple, and that the four of them were probably thick as thieves in their day. You know, they were probably, you know, they're the same age. You know, they had kids the same age. They probably were at each other's house to dinner. And it wouldn't it be nice if, you know, our children got married, and, you know,
that doesn't seem like what it is, though. It seems like a very ritualized, very formalized arranged marriage.
Well, that's the, arranged marriage exists in their culture. I don't think it would be, you get the sense of a couple of the comments they make at dinner. At one point, Loxana says they are, you know, turning more human, and he's, you know, when they're talking about this religious ritual, you know, one of them comments, you know, oh, you never used to be that Betazoid before. So you get the sense that they are, you know, maybe they were into some aspects of Betazoid culture. Maybe they thought the culture was fascinating and moved in when they were younger and lived it and loved the life and, you know, the expat thing. Then they moved back to Earth, but they're still, you know, that was kind of the sense I got. You feel that there is some kind of major, massive falling out between them, but you don't know what it is. And
I mean, my implication, or my sort of, you know, theory about that is, you know, from the little bit we've seen of Betazoid culture so far, I mean, the fact that they get married naked, I think, is very interesting. I mean, that indicates, at least to me, that it's a very, you know, a very sex positive culture.
They explicitly say it's to celebrate the act of love, and, you know,
right. And so if we can take Loxana Troy as representative of Betazoid culture, which I think we have to, because she's the only Betazoid that we've seen so far, that, you know, Betazoid culture must be very sort of like free love and, you know, very free with your emotions, because you would kind of have to, it would be like, if you were a member of a species that could read minds, it would just get exhausting all the time to try and block your thoughts and block your emotions. And so I think there would be an implication there that, like, you know, the culture of Betazoid is very open, is very free. You know, people don't take offense very easily. It would have to be, just because you can't walk around and pretend that you don't know that your boss hates you all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the scene when Troy is talking to both Riker and, you know, her fiancé, and, you know, kind of, and trying to diffuse Riker's jealousy and saying, you know, well, Riker's like, you know, he loves me. And, you know, she almost seems amused at the fact that either of them could be jealous. Like, she doesn't,
I don't think jealousy exists on Betazoid.
Her love for Riker would never be diminished. She knows, and it's made very clear in this episode, that while they would have in a different life, you know, been dating, you know, their professional responsibilities are too major. And also, she did kind of have this arranged marriage hanging over her head, but she seems completely amused by the idea that they could be jealous, or that it could be a problem for them both to love her and her for her, both of them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the implication there, of course, and this is 1987, so they can't say it, but, like, maybe Betazoid is full of polyamorous relationships.
Oh, yeah. And the son doesn't even seem to be bothered by it either. He seems a little amused.
Yeah.
And even beyond the...
Well, that's, I mean...
Part of it because he doesn't love her, but part of it because, I guess, again, I think he finds that idea kind of foreign, too. Maybe he... I mean, he was raised on Beta Zoya.
Yeah, I would assume so.
So?
I think, you know, I want to talk about Riker a little bit because he's not in the episode much, but I think he's important to the episode in a way. And... Riker seems very buttoned up in this episode in a way that we haven't seen before. I think this episode paints him as maybe a bit more, I don't want to say sex negative, but he's sort of conservative. Maybe he's monogamous. He's sort of a romantic, perhaps. I mean, he definitely has no problems watching sexy harp hologram ladies. Like, what the hell was that?
I wonder if it's even a case of Betazoid culture is taking her away from him, so he's kind of even being more, he seems almost reactionary against that. In other words, this culture that does practice free love and does have this make in marriage ceremony is what's preventing, you know, is what's making Troy leave the ship, so he's against it. And it's not a rational decision, but it is a very human decision for him to attitude for him to take.
I definitely think there's some of that there. I don't disagree with you. The thing that I sort of took away from it, and again, I'm sort of filling in the blanks in the episode because the episode doesn't do a good job at shading or anything like that, is that, you know, Riker is again very conservative. He's very monogamous. He believes in, you know, getting married and to your one true love and getting old together and popping out some kids or whatever. Maybe it just, you know, they split up because Troy is more Betazoid in her cultural beliefs than human. And, you know, she couldn't limit herself. I mean, they say, oh, you'll always be Amzadi to me, right? And there's that scene in the holodeck, which is weird. Kind of the implication I get there is that she wanted Riker, but she didn't want to limit herself to just Riker. And he very much just wanted Troy. He's sort of conservative and old-fashioned in that way. And so maybe that's the tension there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what I'm getting from the episode.
But, you know, here's the two major questions that I'm... You know, the episode gives me in that the scene between... The first scene between Riker and Troy when... After they find... You know, after they're talking about, you know, that she has to get married. And they're kind of talking... And they're kind of talking around, you know, that they do love each other. But, and, you know, he's dealing with the fact that, you know, someone he loves is getting married. And they basically say, you know, and she says, well, you always wanted to be a starship captain. And, you know, we all... And she basically says, you know, we're married to our jobs. You know, we can't...
Which
I wonder why that's the case now.
That's why I say that I think there's something else going on there, because that seems like an excuse.
I mean,
for a fact that there are families on the ship. We know for a fact that there are married people on the ship with kids. So it doesn't seem that strange to me that, you know, this Starfleet doesn't seem like it would have an issue with Riker and Troy being married.
Well, the one thing I will say is they've been vague about how they first met, and it was implied that she was on whatever planet and he was just there for a while and he was temporarily there. I got the sense that he had to, you know, they probably had a conversation where she said, you know, oh, you could stay here. You can, you know, you can leave Starfleet. And he said, no, I want to be a captain. That was a conversation they had. And yes, years may have, where their work did take them different places. Maybe, you know, I got the sense she later decided to join Starfleet, whether it was because of Riker influenced her or that was kind of where she wanted to go professionally. It doesn't really matter. At this point, yes, they are on the same ship. They've also only been on the same ship for a couple months at this point. So they're still getting used to things. Maybe they just haven't had time to rekindle their romance. And now it's... But then
it's too late.
Yeah, but
it's not, but...
Well, my other question here is, and this is exactly yours, why does she have to leave the ship? You get the sense that they... I mean, he very much has his own career and he has his own work. And while they, I think, it, you know, even if they're being married for some kind of, you know, political or social reasons or, you know, financial reasons, they can have an Eleanor and FDR type of relationship. You know, she does say, you know, imagine the work we could do together. And, you know, it is clear that the two of them working in concert would be able to do a lot of good. But at the same time, you know, they don't need to do that 24/7.
I mean, let's put it this way. I don't think that Dr. Crusher would have a problem with Wyatt staying on the ship and becoming some sort of medical officer.
That's another thing. Yeah. You know? He's curious. He's bright. He is, you know, if Crusher has a position open, she's going to give it to her friend's husband. You know, she can. You know, she readily at the dinner, you know, when she finds out he's a doctor, you know, she immediately says, I'd love to get your help on this. You know, your expertise would be very helpful for this. And there will be many, many opportunities for Crusher. I mean, this could have been an episode to add another character in.
Yeah, it could have totally. I mean, you know, and the funny thing is, like, normally a character like this in an episode, a one-off guest star, you know, more often than not would be sort of like a bland character. And, you know, I don't think Wyatt is super interesting as portrayed in this episode, but I think, and part of that is just because he's got this weird subplot where there's some I don't even know if we want to go into that, but but like, you know, that he is kind, there are shades to his character, and there are sort of like deeper threads that are sort of intimated in the episode, at least from the, I think in a lot of this is the portrayal of the actor as Wyatt as well. I don't think it's in the script as written, but I think he kind of gives it a shading and a colorization that isn't there in the script, and I find him interesting.
Well, it's interesting that they set up this contrast in him. I mean, when you first meet him, he is a bit reluctant, he's a bit shy, and, you know, he's, you know, Troy, when she finds out he's a doctor, is surprised, and she explicitly says, you know, you seem like an artist. He doesn't come off as a doctor
here, right,
that we've seen, and that's interesting, you know, and we do see that he is able to draw very well, and he does have an artistic side to himself. And so those two very different disciplines, that very scientific medical expertise and the artistic, you know, dreaminess to him, those do make for a much more interesting character than one would expect. Yes.
Yeah. And I also think that it's not incidental that he doesn't seem like a good fit for Troy.
No.
Especially because what we've seen of Troy's interest in men so far has been Riker. And Riker is very different from Wyatt.
Yeah. It's interesting that she almost seems to want a demonstrative man of action in a way.
I mean, at the same time, I don't think that Troy would be averse to a three-way.
No.
Like, that's the sense I get. Like, yeah. Especially in that holodeck scene where she's very amused by Riker's jealousy and Wyatt comes in. Like, a different version of this show filmed, you know, in 2035 might have ended up in some sort of three-way scene. That's all I'm saying.
No, and, you know, that is the case. Her feelings to Riker do not diminish at all through this episode. And, you know, what she meets of Wyatt, she does find him very sensitive and very charming. I mean, that scene when they're in the holodeck together, that is a lovely conversation between the two of them. You know, that is a very, you know, he is a very good person. She is the kind of person that if they had to get married, it would not be, both of them would have good, they would have a good life together. They would grow to love each other. They would grow to, and again, you know, their skill sets together, as she says, you know, we could work together and do a lot. They do match each other in that way. It's an on paper, a good match, I guess.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, Wyatt was having mysterious dreams about a woman on the Trillian ship. He beams over, and that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, and see, it's one thing if you decide, all right, I'm gonna, you know, the woman that I've dreamed about my whole life, and even though, it's just he gets on that ship, and they're all, like, he sees these, like, it's not just, I mean, he just has a scrapbook filled with drawings that he's made of her, like, he's the only one who seems to be thinking about her. Every single one of those half dozen people they have pictures of Wyatt displayed all over the place, and they're all really excited to meet him. Like,
I mean, there's,
I think he's going through more than a three-way on that
ship. I was about to say there's no version of this episode that doesn't end with him having sex with every single person on the Trillian ship, right?
He can't change his mind now.
No, he's stuck there. Yeah. I mean, basically his only release is sweet, sweet death.
Yeah. This is the worst ending of an episode ever.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like they didn't know how to end the episode, and so they
have the mute guy say one line, and everyone looks at each other all astounded, like, "Wow,
right?
He could really talk that whole time." Yeah. The end.
One naked wedding.
5,000 gong rings. And each gong ring is a negative point.
All right, well, let's move on to a slightly better episode, The Big Goodbye. So I really think that this is Star Trek's first video game episode.
Okay. I would play this game.
The holodeck is a primary focal point in this episode. It's very much, and in this episode is problematic in some ways because, you know, again, I think that a lot of what I'm finding, what rewatching the first season of The Next Generation that I find, you know, extremely interesting is that a lot of the sort of cliches and tropes that, you know, the 80s and 90s versions of Star Trek got sort of calcified into were very much a result of the first season of The Next Generation not being very good. Okay. And that's a problem.
Because being trapped in the holodeck is kind of one of the recurring...
Like the holodeck going awry and sort of like malfunctioning and causing problems is a thing that happens a lot. I mean,
it's a great excuse to get him into cool costumes, certainly.
Yeah. Now, can we blame this on The Big Goodbye? I think we can because, you know, of course we could say, well, The Practical Joker, that was basically a holodeck and that went awry. And it's like, yes, it did, but... four people saw that episode in 1974, so they're not really going to be, you know, they're not really going to know that much about it. That's not what we're going to trace this to. We're going to trace this to The Big Goodbye.
Dear Richard and Eric, I think that the holograph trope could actually be traced to the episode of the animated series, and why wouldn't you know that?
But what I think is interesting about this episode is that the holodeck is really portrayed as... a life, you know, a realistic video game.
Yeah.
You know, Picard is delighted by this thing.
I love that scene. Yeah, when he has the conference and they're ready, he's going to, you know, and he's just totally geeking out about that. And they're like, they think it does sound like when you found this really amazing video game and you're trying to tell your friends and they're like, all right, we'll play it. But like, you keep talking about it.
And it's like, if you watch the reactions of all the characters as they go on the holodeck, you know, Data and Crusher and Picard and the nameless 20th century historian, which is directly an analog to the original series.
Oh, yeah. The second they mentioned, you know, his profession, I'm like, all right, he's going to get killed.
Right. And actually, did they actually say if he died or not?
I think they implicate. Yeah. Cause at the very end, they're like, get that man to sick bay. And so you can assume that they fixed him.
Okay. That's fine. I think a lot of their reactions were very similar to someone who's playing a really awesome video game for the first time. They're delighted by the unreality and the reality of it at the same time. They're having a lot of fun interacting with the NPCs. Like, they are delighted by being put in physical danger because it's not real. And then when it becomes real, they're suddenly like, well, holy shit, this isn't good.
Yeah.
But, and then the episode takes a weird turn. But I think, you know, in the portions of the episode where they're sort of like, there of their own volition, it very much is like, isn't this cool?
Well, yeah, when the best scene for that is when they're all, you know, when they have, they're in the office and they're pointing the gun at them and they all just like kind of sitting and like Dr. Crusher especially just like sits on the thing and like they're all having a great time, you know, because oh my god, we're being, you know, attacked by thugs, you know. I love Dr. Crusher in this episode, number one because that outfit looks amazing, and number two because the bit where when she first gets in there and Data's like, oh, he's being interrogated. She's like, well, why are we being interrogated? I want to be interrogated. Like, she's, you know, she's jealous of the, you know, that Picard's going through a cooler level than she is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I do agree with you that Crusher really comes alive in this episode. And I think so does Picard in a way. But that also is bad because the characters are coming alive... yeah. In a holodeck simulation on a science fiction adventure show. And that's not great.
It's one thing if you're saying, well, you know, this is the first time that we can see them really relax. I mean, I think there was supposed to be an element of that, you know. Picard is always working.
That is a good point.
He and Crusher don't get opportunities to just be silly and just have a fun, you know, time. Like, anytime... I mean, she's a doctor. Anytime she's going on a mission, she is it's if she fails at it, someone's going to die, you know?
Right.
He has even higher, you know, and he's for the most part not on missions, remember. He is usually in the ships. So.
And I actually think that it's, you know, now that you say that, I think that the sort of, I don't know if this episode really has a B plot, but the I guess we can call it that of this insectoid race, which has a very specific you know, language and vocabulary, and you know, Picard needs to say this greeting in the proper way, or basically the implication is that they will destroy the Enterprise. I think is interesting because it does make it seem like Picard does need a lot of rest, and he is being put in some physical danger and some sort of emotional danger at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that pairing works for me. I think.
Yeah, I mean,
you...
at the very beginning when he's working with Troy, and you know, she's like, "No, rest. There's a new holodeck game out. Go." You know, she's all but, you know, grabs him by the scruff of the neck. You know, and
in a different show, you can see Troy going, you know, here's $50. Go down to GameStop and buy. Whatever.
Yeah, like, go to the movies. You know, go and you know, take a nap, read a book. Like, you know, I mean, she's telling him to do that just to get his mind off of it for a bit to, I mean, and that's, you know, that is a teaching thing. Like you can't, you know, he is over preparing at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Here's one of my questions. So in the very first episode, they have this plate, the saucer detaches and there's all this big thing. And I know I was talking with you and I said, you know, isn't it weird that they're, you know, getting in these situations of danger when there's families, and you said, well, they don't really do... In this, we're explicitly told that if they don't do the greeting 100% right, I mean, there's this video, apparently, of what the last ship to encounter them went through, and it's so horrible that they don't even want to see it again, you know? I think they said once you've seen it once, like, you know, it's... You know, this it's like 9/11 towers like level of video apparently in the world.
Well, I think it's just, you know, a ship exploding. I don't think it was supposed to be that bad.
Either way, I don't know. They're really creeped out about it.
I don't know how often would you want to see like a ship explode.
What I'm saying is,
I don't think
this
Why
is this ship with families going on this particular mission? Why don't you put a ship that doesn't have families on it is my
I think that's a fair question.
Like we have seen the
I think, you know, if I don't, you know, I sort of to sort of like defend the episode a little bit, I think the implication is that, you know, the Enterprise probably isn't going to have that happen to it. I don't know. I mean, it's a problem. I agree with you.
It's just one of those I mean, every episode has had the ship in some kind of danger. And while none of this was expected, the Haven episode, they have this, you know, the Talarians are a threat. You know, one does not know what they would do. They couldn't, you know.
Well, I think in Haven, they're more a threat to the planet than to the Enterprise. And I think you're overstating the fact that the Enterprise has been in danger in most of the episodes we've seen so far. I don't think the Enterprise was in danger in Hide and Q. I don't think the Enterprise was in danger in the battle. I don't really think the Enterprise was in danger in the Last Outpost. You know, it's just... A lot of these episodes are not that.
I wouldn't want my kid on this ship.
Well, no, of course not. And, you know, that is definitely an issue with the way the series is constructed, right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that this ship would have kids on it. But
again, you're going on a regular mission to Haven. You're going on, you know, most of the stuff that they're initially doing is fine to have families, but just the vagaries of space travel, while it is more tamed than in Kirk's day, it's not tamed yet.
And you're not going to offload the families every single time you're going to get ordered into a dangerous mission. I mean, that's just going to be time consuming, and that's not feasible. How are you going to do that? Yeah, it is a problem. I think it's just a matter of cognitive dissonance with Star Trek: The Next Generation. You just have to kind of to accept it. You know, there are different explanations you can come up with. People are just more, you know, accepting of death. Who knows? But, you know, it is just something that I don't know how far we can really take it. It's a fine point.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day,
I guess so. And
it's just kind of an accepted, settled matter in the show.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of you just have to go with it or, you're not going to appreciate the show.
Well, I'm not going to appreciate the show then. How about that?
And also it's, you know, like we've said, this is not the best constructed or most well thought out program at this point in time. And so you think you're seeing part of that as well.
I guess it's more than anything. It's just a flaw. You notice a thing you say.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And the episode, I don't feel that this is one of the deeper episodes necessarily. I don't feel that this was, but it was a fun episode. I mean, you can tell that the actors are having fun with it. You know, you can tell that they, anytime, you know, you do a noir pastiche, everyone has fun.
I mean, Gates McFadden is enjoying herself. Brent Spiner is enjoying himself. Oh, Patrick Stewart is definitely enjoying himself.
Is there a moment when Brent Spiner is not enjoying himself, by the way? Like, I get the sense that he is always just thrown into that role and he's having the time of his life.
I don't want to think about Brent Spiner enjoying himself.
Aww.
Don't find him attractive.
Really?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, Data is... He's definitely, if we can call any character in the show at this point in time, a breakout character. He definitely is that character.
I love his going back to the previous episode, when he's the fight at the engagement party, like, he's amused and fascinated. Like, I love how every time, while everyone's horrified, he's amused and fascinated. You know, he throws himself the most into the simulation. You know, he's doing the voice. He's, you know, getting so into this. I like that he's... Data comes off almost very childlike in a lot of ways.
But not in a bad way.
In a very good way. When he learns about something new, he throws himself into it because he wants to experience everything that humans have experienced.
And he wants to learn about it.
Yeah. And he's very... I like that he's a very... He's an innocent character in the sense that he doesn't really question himself. He goes with what he's a very, it's weird. He's a very instinct character in some ways. You know, he likes detective stuff. You know, he hears the name of a detective, so he reads every single book of it. You know, he's that guy.
Right.
I like that about him.
Yeah. And I think, of course, you know, you can't discount the fact that Data is partially curious like that and will throw himself into situations because he is someone who has a lot of physical advantages as well.
Oh, yeah. He grabs the gun and pinches it shut.
He's the guy who's going to read all the Dixon Hill books, but he can do it in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So he definitely is somewhat of a, I wouldn't call him an idiot savant, but he definitely is someone who comes across as...
He has his limit. What are Data's limitations?
Well, he has no emotions, number one. So that may be a limitation, that may not be.
Certain things, idioms and stuff, he doesn't always understand.
Jokes he doesn't get.
But, you know, I don't know. I don't know if he necessarily doesn't have emotions. And I know you said does the show deal with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because certainly from a philosophical point of view, you know, that's the big question that every AI author deals with. Are these simulated emotions? Are these real? What are real emotions that a human feels? You know,
I don't want to give away too much about the development of Data as a character, but I will say that Data is in these episodes that we've seen so far, a slightly different version of Data than becomes sort of the canon Data.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Completely.
In the same way that Spock smiled a few times in the first few episodes of the original series, that goes away and the reality of the character becomes different than what he is initially conceived as and played as.
Okay. I can see that.
You know, he does smile in this episode quite a bit. He seems to be having fun. Can you have fun if you don't have emotions?
But again, what is...
I'm asking you. I don't know.
Well, you know...
I assume you can, but what does... fun is an emotion. Fun is a feeling.
Well, here's the thing with... are you... Again, and this is from this... I believe the concept is philosophical zombie. Something which is... how would you tell the difference between a Data that is legitimately expressing an emotion and a Data which is perfectly replicating an emotion in every way?
Right.
And, you know... And again, the that does bring the thing of, you know, as a person, what does it mean when I Richard Goodness, am feeling happiness, you know?
Right.
Is that a physical thing I am feeling, or is it essentially a series of emotions that my cells are going through? I mean, that is, I guess, where I find the interest of that character in, because whether Data has emotions or not that's not an answer. That's the beginning of a very long, you know, journey of questioning things. And I like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, for example, Descartes and some other philosophers in like the 18th century were very famous for, you know, saying that animals had no emotions.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And even could not feel pain, for example.
Yeah. And Descartes specifically said that a dog was like a wheel squeaking, like when it cried out in pain.
Yeah. Right, right. Like the same way that, you know, you need to oil a gate or something. And very famously, he sort of nailed dogs to boards and like cut them open and sort of was like, here's the heart and here's, you know, terrible, terrible stuff. And one of the funny things that I heard a while ago was that I think there was a neurologist or something that trained dogs to go into MRI machines, you know, because an MRI machine, you have to stay very still. You can't move to get a proper, you know, and so
it's loud.
It's loud. It's an enclosed environment. It's not a good environment for a dog, but he was able to find dogs, like I think 12 dogs or something like that, which you could train to stay in an MRI machine for enough time to get a scan of their brain. And what he found is that, you know, the sort of areas of the brain that correspond to the areas of the brain that light up in an MRI machine when humans are, you know, given some stimuli that elicits emotions in them, that happens in dogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of animal rights and personhood and things like that is very controversial. But, you know, I think in the same way, you know, Data is a problem because, we can sort of solve the question of whether or not animals have emotions and have feelings to some satisfaction because they are very similar to us biologically. Yeah. Data is not.
But he has pores like we do.
Right. But he doesn't, you know, you can't put Data in an MRI machine. He's just not a biological being. He is and he isn't, right? Like he's got this biological skin and he's got he has pumping whatever oil or whatever in his veins, but he's not a biological being in the sense that he has like a brain, like an android brain. It's more of a circuit board. And so you can't do that. So I don't know, you know, this is all sort of like, I don't know how to answer the question of whether or not Data has emotions. And I think
that's because philosophy has not answered the question of whether we have emotions.
But, we do.
I get
very tired of philosophy in general.
Yeah.
Like, I just find it sort of like intellectual masturbation a lot of the time.
Oh, that's the point of it.
But you know, not to like shut that conversation down, but... But, you know, I think like, you know, we have to go by what Data can tell us.
Okay.
So Data is, you know, I can't ask my dog if he has emotions. I know he has emotions because I see it. And then I go by what I sense. But we have to ask Data, does he have emotions? And, you know, Data can talk. Data is a person, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know how you feel about it, but, you know.
That's very interesting that you can give him personhood, but don't necessarily suggests that his performance of emotion is a legitimate emotion. That's
because he says it's not. That's the thing. It's like in these early
does Data know himself in that regard?
Well, that could be. Yeah, I don't know.
You know, I
and to be fair, a lot of this is sort of like established canon later on that I don't really want to get into right now. And a lot of it is problematic, and you're probably going to hate a lot of it based on this conversation. But I think you know, like. I just have to go by what Data says. And if Data says he doesn't feel emotions, then okay, he doesn't feel emotions. You know, is that true? I don't know.
But, but then, you know, he does definitely exhibit curiosity. There is no... He could be performing happiness. He could be performing, you know, whatever. But the curiosity is genuine. From everything we have seen him as, that is his personality, that he hears about something, he has a desire to learn about it. I mean, desire at its base. He wants to be human. That's desire. I mean, if you're saying that Data has no emotions. Well, he has desire, and desire is an emotion to me.
Well, here's the, I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
Here's the real question. Data may have the higher emotions, but he doesn't have the lower emotions, right? Like, he can't be afraid, for example, because that is a very basic physiological response to external stimuli. But he can have these sort of like more abstract emotions for whatever reason.
Well, what's the difference between...
I'm just postulating that as a theory.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's the difference between... So you have a big scary monster growls at Data. He's not going to be afraid because he doesn't have a fear response. But you have that same big monster growling at Spock, and he's not going to show any emotion either.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
I don't know.
Because Spock has emotions, we are told. He suppresses them. He ignores them. He doesn't find them important enough to overtake whatever else, you know, the logic goes. But
I think the only answer I have for that is Data was never... That is a learned behavior. And Spock grew up in a culture and a society which taught its children how to suppress their emotions, right?
Yeah.
Data was not. So, and fear is such a basic response, and it's a response that is there because it protects us, right? Like, it's the flight or fight response, right?
Yes.
That it doesn't seem likely to me.
And given that, the evolutionary reason for fight or flight, by the way, we can assume that Vulcans have it as well.
Yeah, of course. So it doesn't seem likely to me that Data would have independently decided to learn how to suppress his flight or flight response, if that makes sense.
I guess you mean he wouldn't have had a fight or flight response triggered.
No, I'm saying he probably did. I mean, he's a Starfleet officer. How many times has he gone into battle? Like, he's had triggers. He has no response to them because he doesn't have a fear response.
Well, I guess what I mean, like, he has had moments which would have triggered a fight or flight response if that response were capable of being triggered.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
right.
In other words, he's not going to even think to be afraid because, you know, a guy with a gun pointed at him doesn't, you know, to you, let's call it programming for you and me. Someone points a gun at one of us, we're going to react in a terrified way. Data is not, because he doesn't, you know, he sees a gun, he's programmed to think about the gun. He's programmed to think about the way to get out of the gun. He's not programmed in a way to fear for his own life.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's link this back to the hologram program, right?
Yeah.
The holodeck program. Because you have characters in the holodeck, which, you know, NPCs basically, right? Like, they're not real people. And, you know, Picard tries to get out of this situation, not successfully, because, you know, Wesley and Geordi fix the computer or whatever they do. It's not really important with the little binoculars. Picard decides to try and get out of this situation by telling the computer-controlled, not real people that he is not Dixon Hill, that these are not people that are from this planet. Weird stuff. That's a weird decision on his part. It doesn't work. But you
do realize that Picard is going in, lives in a culture, and his job is basically to diplomatically resolve things. I mean, in his mind, I think that basic technique would have worked enough on... You know, he's really not used to arguing with holodeck people, I guess, is the...
I guess that could be the case. And I think, you know, it's interesting to me that he thinks that that will work. I also think it's interesting that the holodeck person exhibits some of the aspects of personhood, especially that he leaves the holodeck. And of course, it's ridiculous that he would sort of like disappear like the Wicked Witch of the West because there are no holodeck, you know, projector things out there. So that's ridiculous. But for the purposes of dramatic tension, I'll accept it.
I mean, I thought that was funny because I think it does. I mean, that it gives an imp- I loved that character, the Red Book or Red Box.
Right.
The fat man character from Maltese Falcon, obviously. I mean, he's no Sidney Greenstreet, but He's as the pastiche of noir. He's having a good time with it. He's an over the top character. He is an interesting character.
Yeah.
And I like that his response to being told, well, you're not really real. And, you know, there is another world. His response is to basically roll with it and say, okay, well,
yeah,
I've been through enough weird shit in my life, because a guy like that would have seen some weird shit in his time. He's not even scared or bothered by it. He's just thinking, all right, well, anytime I see a thing, I'm going to plunder it. You know, he's just looking for, you know, for the gold, really. I like that. I think that's funny.
And I guess in the sense that if you consider this to be a it's kind of unclear exactly how the holodeck works and how holodeck programs work. But if you assume that the computer is sort of controlling these characters and they have, in the same way that like video game characters have sort of like some movements and some things that they have programmed in and some AI, very limited AI, that, you know, this is 300 years out.
You can assume the AI.
They have better AI. So this character, it may not be that he is recognizing the reality of the situation. It may just be that he is going with how he was programmed. And what he's programmed to do is plunder, get rich. He wants to look for the big score. This looks like a big score, so he's going to leave.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think about it, if you had a character, you know, if there was a character in that simulation who, let's say, read science fiction magazines, and then Picard is telling him, I'm really a space captain from the future. You're going to have that character wanting to say, well, I want to see what that is. That sounds really cool. He's going to think of himself as in a real life book. You know, remember, those characters have officially read adventure books before or whatever. So,
yeah. But I think this episode is interested in asking the question. I don't know that it's adept enough to answer the question, because I don't know that Tracy Torme is a good enough writer to really answer the question. Because especially at the end, when Picard leaves and the character of the police officer is there, and he says, like, you know, when you leave, are my wife and kids going to be waiting for me to get home? And Picard says, you know, I don't know. You know, I think, you know, a better script would have gone with that ambiguity a little more. I mean,
I like that they, and this is more of a directorial choice, I'd assume, when they close the door and it just ends in darkness, and it just kind of, like, that last shot of the holodeck scene does keep with that ambiguity a bit. You don't see, you know, in a way that you see when the holodeck closes earlier and you see the Peter Lorre type character, you know, looking for, you know, Dixon or whatever. You do see a scene in the holodeck after Picard leaves. It is a persistent world in that way.
It could just be that it takes the holodeck a few minutes to turn off.
Of course. And yeah, that's another thing too. If they had ended the shot showing the guy still in his office and pacing around, that would have suggested, no, there is a realness to this. If it had them disappearing, it would have answered the, well, they're not, you know, they just get stored away.
In the same way that it takes a game you play on your computer a few seconds to shut down fully.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that they just, you know, give it a black screen,
it's still in memory or whatever.
I can see why they wanted to go out of their way to resolve that question, especially on episode 12 or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. The final thing I want to say about this episode, and then we can wrap it up, is why the hell don't they just beam them out of the holodeck? Like, did Tracy Torme forget that the holodeck exists? That would be the transporter exists?
Yeah. You see, what the question for me that I thought was the funniest was, so Wesley and Geordi at the end are looking, and Wesley says, you know, if this has got a chance of either escaping or they'll all vanish. Why would they vanish? Like, I could see if it said something like, you know, if this goes up, the power surge is going to, you know,
the,
and I can't,
the holodeck destroys all matter at the end. And if you don't get out before you end the program, you, like, die. I don't know.
You know, give it a couple of things. Give it, you know, it could, you know, they could have electric shock. They could, you know, it could be a traumatic, you know, like,
whatever.
There's a number of different malfunctions that could happen to kill them. And that would make more sense.
Right. Than them all vanishing.
Yeah.
I agree.
I just don't think they know what the holodeck is. I mean,
that's fair.
It's
a magic room where they play real life video games. That's basically what it is.
Aren't they in real life in a room about, you know, the size of, you know, the room we're recording in now, and it just looks like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe a little bigger. I don't know how big it's supposed to be, but
You know, do they have at this point, they really need to put a manual release hatch just for things of this nature.
That's the other thing is, like, would it really be that difficult to force that door open?
If they can't, I mean, yeah, like, if they can't find it, well, you need to get...
Like, the door is physically there.
They just can't see it, yeah.
Right, so...
So you find a sledgehammer and you start bashing every wall, like, it's...
Yeah, I don't know. You could poke holes in it all day, but...
I'd love to poke holes in the wall of the holodeck, because that way you can get out of it.
I don't know, what would you give this one?
Again, it wasn't... It's an episode that falls apart when you look at it in the light of day, but it was a fun episode. And especially compared to Haven. So I'd give it it's a solid 5 episode. You know, it's nothing to write home about. I can see there being better holodeck episodes, but I had a fun time watching it.
4 for me.
Okay.
And I'm sort of grading these on a curve because I know how good the show gets later.
I can see that.
So I don't want to blow my wad this early, but, you know.
You know, I really don't care because the rating system isn't real.
Yeah, I know. Well, next week, we are going to cover Data Lore.
Oh, no.
And Angel One.
Oh, no.
We'll see you then.